This episode is brought to you by Videoblocks.com. Go to Videoblocks.com/notalone to save 84% on an annual subscription to one of the most comprehensive and highest quality libraries of stock footage out there. That's VideoBlocks.com/notalone.
Ace Podcast.
This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Hello and welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I'm Sam Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitoso.
And today we are covering my absolute top of the list most favorite place in the entire world. I already made a Facebook post on the Facebook page about how when I die I would like to be buried there.
Dairy Queen?
Dairy Queen. Close.
Do-do-douche. That's it. I'm done.
Ba-da-tsh.
So long.
everything you hear from now will just be me. Any Jason you hear will just be pre-recorded segments because he just walked out the door.
We have a soundboard.
See? That was the first one. All right. So, no. Dairy Queen is a good guess. I do love it. But we are talking about one of the strangest. I say this like every week. One of the strangest, most bizarre. But it truly is the strangest, most bizarre area in at least the United States, in my opinion, if not the entire freaking world.
Yeah, this entire show, I've got literally nothing.
We are talking about the number one, the heavyweight champion of the spooktacular world, Skinwalker Ranch. Skinwalker Ranch.
We need air horns for that. You need to add an air horns right now.
I don't know how to do that. I'm sorry. I'm not very good at editing.
That's it. Let me go back. I'll go home, get my air horn. We'll do this all over again.
I have an arsenal of air horns. So we're talking about Skinwalker Ranch, which is, as you will see...
They're not seeing anything, Sam.
As you will hear...
Thank you.
I think it was actually Linda Godfrey in her book Monsters Among Us where she says it's a paranormal sampler. It's like... You can't decide on an appetizer, so you pay $20 and you get all the appetizers on one plate. It's like that, but with the paranormal. You have Bigfoot, you have aliens, you have Native American legends, you have poltergeist activity, you have sea monsters, you have...
You don't have sea monsters, it's Utah.
You have reservoir monsters.
Okay.
You have...
They're not real.
Everything. Okay, anyway. So, yeah, we are going to go ahead... And Jason, you got anything you want to say? Any questions, concerns, happy thoughts, sad thoughts?
I'm already a little frustrated.
That's fair. That's totally fine.
Well, right. Skinwalker Ranch is literally just the hotspot. It is where you have to have a tinfoil hat on.
Because you'll die if you don't.
Everything apparently happens here.
Yeah.
So it's crazy. Skinwalker is either... the most paranormal location in the world, or it just induces mass
hysteria.
It's incredible. We will all hear your stories and definitely see for ourselves.
One of our partners in the Dark Myths, he said Skinwalker Ranch is like the biggest yes and exercise he's ever heard, like an improv. Uh-huh. When you're just supposed to keep saying yes and also this and this.
Right.
And that's
right.
Exactly what
it just keeps
things up. And that is.
Pulling up on itself. There's more and more and more that just keeps happening.
It's
a mountain of paranormal activity.
Yes. Let's do it. So this is the first of at least two parts. It may be three parts. We may have an extra bonus part as well. It may be a total of four parts. But at the very, the longest it's going to take us to do this is 3 weeks, regardless. We're just going to start it. We're going to see how it goes. We're going to cut when we cut, and we'll pick up where we pick up. So we have to, though, set some context, because not only do we have to know about the ranch and the area, we also have to know the superstitions, the beliefs, and all of that. So
did you first hear about Skinwalker Ranch from Linda Godfrey's book, or was that
no.
was this one of the first ones?
I don't
was
know.
This like, it just
here's
happened.
The,
it was like the farthest back you can remember, Skinwalker Ranch was always there.
I do not know.
I
learned about Skinwalker Ranch, I think, from one of these message boards, and primarily it's because of Skinwalkers, which is my absolute favorite phenomena of all time, which I think I came across during, like, so I think it was that I first learned about Slenderman, and then Slenderman took me to the Rake, and then the Rake took me to Skinwalkers somewhere in there.
I mean, Skinwalkers are just really cool, very specific shape shifters.
Yeah.
Very specific shape shifters, like their lore and everything. It's weird. I don't feel like there's a ton of Skinwalker activity, though. Like, compared to all the other stuff that keeps going on, it feels cool. Like, I know, right?
You're so wrong. Okay.
And Skinwalker Ranch was the first podcast I had actually ever listened to.
That's true. I made him.
So, yeah.
Right before we started recording this, or like the day before
I listened
our first
to a
episode.
Total of like six podcasts.
Mm-hmm. I made him
first
listen
one was Skinwalker.
To Astonishing Legends series on Skinwalker Ranch. Well, why don't we go ahead? We're going to set the stage.
Yeah, sorry. I got
the first thing,
a little
no,
bit
dude,
more off topic.
The first thing that we're going to talk about is actually the legend of the Skinwalker itself. Like I said, Skinwalkers are my favorite, and they correspond with my other favorite, which is Wolfmen. A lot of Wolfmen.
Yeah, there's some layover.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, some layering.
He just put one hand on top of the other for anyone who
Vin
couldn't
died.
See.
I know, right?
Because this
I was
is
like,
not
this
a
is
visual
stupid.
Medium. Now, the Skinwalker legend figures most prominently in the Navajo culture, but it's found in multiple tribes of the First Peoples of North America. And it's said to originally come from the Anasazi people, which is the ancestral group of many First Tribes, who emerged originally in the American Southwest around the 12th century BC. I'd like to say really quick, not an expert on any of this. Did some research, did some homework. Especially if you have more intimate knowledge of the Skinwalker phenomena, and I say something that's not true or anything, please let me know. Because again, I want to learn as much as I can about this. So
pretty much everything we're saying with a little asterisk at the end.
Yes, exactly. Now, the majority of sources claim that the Skinwalker is essentially a witch. The Skinwalker is someone who had access to the knowledge of the mystical, the magical, the spiritual, and used it for evil. Usually they accomplished this transformation from man to Skinwalker by the killing of a close family member or killing of a tribe member in a ritualistic manner in order to invoke the powers of darkness and grant them supernatural powers.
It's like you fully falling to the dark side.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. It really is. I think I have this in down here a little bit, but we'll go ahead and talk about it. In Navajo culture, the magical in the world is not like things are not good nor evil. The magic exists.
It's just how it's how
you use
it.
The magic is mystical and it's how it's used. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, you have, like, on the good side, you have the shaman, the medicine men, who heal and uplift and edify the community.
Right.
And
white,
protect them.
White magic versus
sure.
black magic.
Exactly, yeah. On the other side, you have the mirror image. But this gets even a little deeper into Skinwalker culture, because essentially, or Skinwalker lore, because essentially they are mirror images. Even the rituals that take place are supposed to mirror each other and just be like slightly twisted,
okay,
one way or the other.
So it's not like I can perform the same ritual but be like wanting to get a positive outcome, like mentally. Like I can't be like performing one ritual and being in a proper state of mind, like a happy place, and trying
no,
to.
No, this is intent.
It's not off of my will.
Right. This
okay.
is a matter of forced intent, and that's the thing about it. It's like.
Because
a lot
could
of
you
times,
imagine, real quick, just yeah. being a shaman and being able to, like, got the whole tribe together, you're doing a ritual, and then you're like, ha, joke's on you. You thought I was doing that. And then.
I'm
the path
not
of darkness.
Following. Okay. The path of darkness. And that's one of the things that makes the Skinwalker so disturbing, because it's oftentimes related to the European concept of the werewolf, where essentially you have, like I was saying a moment ago, one of the biggest powers of the Skinwalker is shapeshifting, and essentially taking these animal skins and using them to assume animal forms, one of which is the wolf, because of its prominence in First Peoples culture.
Berserkers.
Yeah, exactly.
Some of that kind of a feel.
Mm-hmm. And you also have like the coyote, you have the crow, the eagle, that sort of thing.
How do you wear a crow?
Well, probably just
you
feathers.
Need a few of them.
That's fair, Jason. But the difference is, whereas the werewolf, that is something that is a force that acts upon you, right? You're an innocent, normal person.
Right, there's lycanthropy. It's not your fault, it's a curse.
Well, not even that. It's that you're an innocent, normal person, and you get bit by a werewolf, and then against your will,
curse.
You're a werewolf. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas with the Skinwalker, this is
it's like a demonic pact.
Yeah, exactly. It's a matter of saying, this is what I want, and I am going to actively seek that out. And that's one of the reasons that it's such a, it's just so much more sinister than the werewolf, for instance. Now, like I was saying, the animal form of skinwalkers are usually shapes of animals that figure prominently in folklore, like coyote, fox, wolf, owl, or crow, as well as the eagle, but they can actually take any form that they want, and they can even theoretically change their human shape into another human shape. And they can look like your mother, your father, your aunt, your best friend, whoever. Now, in their animal form, the creatures are often deformed. They're either extremely large, or they'll be twisted and unnatural, or most of the time, both. One of the telltale markers are the eyes. And if you see a skinwalker in human form, it's going to have animal eyes. You're going to be looking into the eyes of a man, but feel like it's the eyes of a wolf. And then vice versa. You'll be looking into the eyes of the wolf, but feel like you're looking into the eyes of a man. To see and identify a skinwalker is a death sentence. As soon as they realize that you know who they are and you know what they are, you're going to be killed. That's no two ways around it. But you do have these stories, dozens and dozens of them, of people identifying skinwalkers while in their animal form. And
how do you do that? How do you, like, well, if you see a skinwalker, I mean, like, it's not like you instantly know who they are as a human.
No. Sorry. Identifying that they are a skinwalker. Not necessarily just like a weirdly shaped crow. Holy crap, that's Jeff.
If it's Jeff again, I will be so upset.
But by saying, you know, this is a skinwalker, and sometimes as well, even without knowing, like, for instance, there are stories of people, who would say that they were out walking and a wolf attacked them, and they shot the wolf and it hit the wolf in the upper front left leg.
In a very identifiable spot.
Exactly. And then the next day.
And then a human having the same wound in the same location.
The person who is either someone who's already looked down upon by the tribe or has a particular beef with the victim, well, guess what? They have a bullet wound in their left arm, you know. That sort of thing.
So, skinwalkers are typically outcasts then of their tribes?
Oh, yeah. It's No, you're good.
So, they do kind of mirror a lot of, like, witchcraft practices.
Yes.
In Europe.
They are.
That kind of a feel.
Yeah. They are, just like witches in Europe,
mm-hmm.
they are the antithesis of good, rightful culture. Like, everything that a Navajo should be, or everything that a Navajo shouldn't be, is what the skinwalker is. Just like everything a witch is what a normal European shouldn't be.
Gotcha. So do they ever use, or do they ever try to say, like, rival tribes were just tribes of skinwalkers or anything like that? Was there anything like that occurred?
Not anything I can see. There is, and we'll get into it here. There is, like, using on rival tribes, but not necessarily. A skinwalker wouldn't necessarily have a tribe. It wouldn't be a tribe of people. It would be a subsection of culture. For instance, there would be stories about the skinwalkers of a tribe who mm-hmm. would meet, or of neighboring tribes all coming together, and they'd meet in caverns and caves late at night.
So it's kind of like
create their own little community that way.
Cult-esque
mm-hmm.
activity.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And in these caves, they would like do these twisted ceremonies, usually involving like cannibalism and things like that, murder. They would identify their targets, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Other schools of thought regarding the Skinwalker is that it is, instead of a human being, it is a spirit which possesses human beings, much like the Wendigo, or it will also manifest by itself. Now, the other thing about the Skinwalker is you're not supposed to look into its eyes. You will become possessed by doing so. So just keep that in mind. Never look anything in the eye, ever, just in case. That's my personal life philosophy. Now, in this philosophy, the Skinwalker spirit itself may either possess an evildoer, or it will be the source of that evildoer's power, essentially. And it will give them superhuman speed and shape-shifting abilities and all of that while playing behind the scenes. But the biggest problem with us talking about Skinwalkers, and other than the fact that if you talk about Skinwalkers, you alert the Skinwalkers, so that's not great. But the problem is, in line with that kind of thinking, the Skinwalker legend is not necessarily openly shared. It's not a free exchange of ideas and culture between the First Peoples.
It's not polite conversation.
Exactly. One of the sources that I found, who was a Navajo, a member of the Navajo tribe, said that the Skinwalkers, even on the reservations, were not talked about unless they were behind closed doors, and even then only if the door had a rug in front of it. It's just not something you bring up even with other tribal members, but especially not with white people. Because of this, so much of what we know about the Skinwalker is speculation. Now, the interesting thing about it is the Skinwalker may or may not factor prominently in the story of Skinwalker Ranch, apart from one notable tenant apart from one notable instance in history, which was the events that were leading up to the Long Walk of the Navajo. Now, the Long Walk, which is not something we're going to cover particularly in depth, was the apex of the United States hostility towards the Navajo tribe. It began in 1864 and ended near the end of 1866. The Navajo were forced to march over 300 miles from their lands in Arizona to a new settlement in New Mexico. Of course, they weren't cared for during this time. They weren't permitted to rest. There were even stories of women who were pregnant, who their families were forced to just leave them behind on the trail to give birth, and more often than not, did not catch up, did not make it to the tribe. And modern-day anthropologists say that this traumatic event of the Long Walk is the bedrock, is such a core tenet of the Navajo people's psyche and worldview. But this was just the climax, and the Americans had a vital ally in their subjugation of the Navajo people leading up to this climax, and that was the Ute tribe. Now, the Ute would work with the United States Army, and they would raid Navajo tribes on the Army's behalf, as well as they captured members of the Navajo and sold them as slaves to the Spanish. The Utes and the Navajo had a tenuous relationship throughout their entire history, but these actions officially broke any semblance of goodwill or any positive relationship between the tribe. And of course, eventually the Utes were also resettled, placed onto reservations by the United States government, with many of the Utes residing on land in northeastern Utah, which was named for the tribe. Now, the land was given to the tribe, the Ute tribe, officially by the government with the 1865 Treaty of the Utah Reservation. However, as was often the case when it came to native reservations, over time, white settlers decided that they wanted more and more of the land that was promised to the nation, or to the natives, and eventually the land is parceled out, and the natives are left with a lot less, a fraction of the land that they were originally promised. The Navajo people also had one last parting gift for the Utes. Now, it was said that harnessing these evil ways of magic, the Navajo placed a hex on the Utes to be pursued and hunted by the Skinwalker. There have been accounts of Skinwalker activity in the Utah Basin since the early 19th century, according to one of our sources, and the Utes refuse to enter Skinwalker Ranch or the land around it because they say it is in the path of the Skinwalker, and it is essentially cursed. It's off limits and forbidden for any tribal member to step foot on it. Now, this area that we're discussing, the Uintah Basin, it is a large area in the earth. It spans much of northeastern Utah as well as parts of western Colorado. And the basin also is, like, if Skinwalker Ranch is a sampler of paranormal activity, the basin is like the restaurant of paranormal activity.
Perfect.
Perfect.
This is what I wanted. A full buffet.
A full buffet of the spooks. It is one of the most active UFO hotspots in the world, as well as some just straight up spooky activity. One of the most notable records on the activity in the basin is the Utah UFO display, which is by Frank B. Salisbury. In the book, he catalogs many of the remarkable sightings that have taken place, and he partners with an individual by the name of Junior Hicks, who is a local science teacher and also like the unofficial paranormal historian of the basin. Now, Hicks has made meticulous notes on every sighting he could catch wind of, both from when he first started to going back as far as he could. The first sighting that he explored took place in the 1950s with a cigar-shaped craft landing, and it was observed by over 30 students as well as their teachers from about 50 feet away. From there, he went to catalog over 400 other alleged sightings of actual craft, not just the thousands of reports of lights in the sky that he got. The craft have been described as almost every type and color and size and shape known to modern ufology. Some seem to be your typical flying saucers, others are triangular, some are 20 feet across, others are 300 feet across. He has stories of people shooting at these craft, hearing their bullets ricochet off. And just like Whitley Strieber's Hidden Choir, it's a cross-section of people. It's not just, you know, the people you would think would see. It's not just me seeing the UFOs. It's me and also people like Jason and people like my wife and people like you.
I don't think like people like me.
And people like your family and people probably like your not. Friends. Hicks estimated that over 10% of the inhabitants of the Uintah Basin, especially in that particular area in Utah, had seen a craft or seen lights of some sort. Now, the only defining characteristic of the basin, the only thing that Hicks could think that they were looking for, is a substance known as gilsonite. Now, trace amounts of this can be found all over the world, but its only large-scale natural deposits have been found in the Uintah Basin.
Ah, we found a coincidence.
Shut up. Now, it resembles obsidian. It's used for a variety of purposes, from paints to lacquers to electrical insulation, waterproofing, manufacturing.
So is it flexible?
It's
a powder? We would turn it into powder, I'm assuming?
Maybe they grind it down into a powder and then use it to make a powder. They used it for...
Use it to make death sticks.
They used it... one of the most well-known uses was it was the finish on the model... What was it? The Model T? Ford car? Early Ford
car? Yeah, Model T.
They used it, that specific substance was used for that beautiful glossy finish of the first automobiles.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Okay.
It's pretty neat. It is a little spurious,
seems
but...
a bit eccentric.
It does. But like I said, it's like what else would there be? Now, gilsonite was valuable enough for mining companies to petition Congress to strip away 7,000 acres from the Uintah Reservation so that American companies could mine there. And of course, they said, sure, that sounds good with us. Now, the other possibility is that the craft in the basin are interested in the biological diversity of the different kinds of plant and animal life that resides there.
The fauna.
The fauna and the flora. Junior Hicks has reports of witnesses seeing craft descend, alien beings coming out of the craft, harvesting plant life, which I just imagine as literally just picking flowers.
Collecting fauna and flora.
Now, the basin also has reports of cryptids, such as Bigfoot.
Are there any other cryptids, or just
Bigfoot, big old wolves, as we're gonna
obviously
see.
Yeah.
As well as an extreme amount of cattle mutilations, obviously commonly associated with extraterrestrial activity,
which is so odd.
What?
That cattle mutilations don't escalate into human mutilations.
Right. It's because of that pact that we signed with the Greys.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's literally, that's yeah.
part of that.
It is part of that. Now, one other notable aspect of the base, and I promise we're creeping closer and closer to Skinwalker Ranch, but it's a reservoir known as Bottle Hollow, which sits right on the edge of the ranch. And it got its name for the many empty whiskey bottles that were chucked into it back in the Wild Wild West days.
Oh, that sounds pleasant.
Mm-hmm. It's a ravine, and the Utes have long believed that there were sea serpents that lived there. And sightings of the creatures have occurred since the government redirected water to it to create a giant reservoir back in 1970. Now, one witness was a tribal police officer who claimed to see great snakes swimming in the water, and other disturbing accounts include, one of which includes many witnesses, state that there was a Ute woman who was swimming along with her male companion one night, and witnesses on the beach claimed that she started screaming and appeared to be being pulled underneath the water. She was screaming that something had her. The man dove deep and told authorities that under the water there was a great snake that he grappled with, but failed to see her, or failed to save her. There were also tales of lights coming in and out of the water. One story told to Colm Kelleher and George Knapp and published in their book, The Hunt for the Skinwalker, which is where the majority of research for episode one is coming from, and you should all read it. It's fantastic. Was of four young white men who had taken their dates to the shores of Bottle Hollow back in 2000.
I wonder what they're going
to
do.
Well, there's four of them, so hopefully nothing too weird. I mean, just to be straight.
Skip some rocks.
Now, they saw a ball of light coming from the direction of the ranch. It plunged into the water just a few feet from shore, and then a few moments later emerged as what they described of as a belt of light, which stayed low to the ground and moved back to the ranch with impossible speed. So, let's follow that belt of light through time and through space, and we are going to land on Skinwalker Ranch. That was kind of cheesy, but I don't care. I'm keeping it in. I thought it was nice. So now we arrive finally at the ranch. Skinwalker Ranch, which is also known as the Sherman Ranch, is a small plot of land in Utah, and it is the home to the most diverse, terrifying experiences I've ever heard of. Now, the owners of the ranch during this time period that we're looking at, which is 1994 to start, that's where we're starting, 1994. The owners of the ranch are Terry and Gwen Sherman, who are, by all accounts, good, honest, hardworking American ranchers.
Oh, man, it always starts that way.
It does. It's so cliche that it's always the ranchers. Now, Terry spent...
Good. Hard-working Americans.
Now, Terry spent years raising beef cattle and was a regional expert in hands-on animal husbandry. Now, his wife, Glenn, was said to have the business sense of the operation, and they were staking out a new place to call home. In 1994, they found, nestled within the Utah Basin, a ranch that would fit their needs and was also extremely affordably priced.
Always red flag.
Always a red flag.
Every horror movie I've seen that they buy a house, extremely good value, just don't do it.
You want to hear?
Just don't do it.
You want to hear some
they're
red flags?
They're not selling it for market value.
You don't want
you
it.
You know you're getting screwed some way.
This is now a mortgage podcast.
You're
We're
welcome.
We're going to give you financial advice. Now, if you want red flags, let's do it. They noticed during the sales process some strange requests from the previous owners, who were an elderly couple. Essentially, what had happened is the previous owners died 7 years before the Shermans bought the ranch. But it hadn't, it like moved from person to person to person to person. Nobody stayed there for any period of time. And these requests that the previous owners had made were still in effect when they bought the ranch.
The ones that died.
The ones that died. it was still part of the deal of buying the ranch.
So, yeah, you have to pull out the Ouija board to be like, hey,
well,
I want to dig over here.
Right. Well, and that's the thing is it states that the Shermans are not allowed to dig on the ranch without first alerting the previous owners, which, again,
do we know who these previous owners were?
We know a little bit, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in episode 2 of this series.
They went through some shit,
bro. They appeared to have done that.
Okay.
Now, again, they were dead, so it was kind of weird that they would need to try to alert them. It is. It's like pulling out the Ouija board and going from there. But they kind of didn't think too much of it. They thought, okay, they were just eccentric old people, plus the price was so good.
I bet Ouija boards have dial-up.
What? Like Ouija boards are pieces of wood.
Well, I mean, it's cardboard, really. But, like, when you think about it, that would be how you, like, contact the other side is through dial-up.
A hardwired connection.
I just want that sound and that misery.
Oh,
they're
no.
Like, ah.
It is eternal suffering.
Exactly. That is the sound that haunts my nightmares.
When using dial-up, you become part of the damned.
Now, that's how you get there.
They also noticed, and again, red flag, didn't really give it any mind, but what they did notice is they entered the farmhouse was a disproportionate number of locks and deadbolts. Every door, whether it was into the house or within the house into the closet or into the bedroom or anything there, every door had several heavy deadbolts attached, not only on the inside, but also on the outside.
Wow, safety first.
Safety first forever, apparently.
Well, I mean, when you can't get, like, home alarm systems, right?
I guess, but I guess the weird thing about it is you're locking things in as much as you're locking things out. You see, because there was a deadbolt on the outside of the door.
Oh, no, Sam, I was paying perfectly good attention. I'm just trying to rationalize it for myself.
So that you're not too spooked?
It's weird.
It's strange.
It's a red flag,
that
you're saying.
In and of itself, just the thoughts that brings up is one of the scariest things about this ranch for me. It's like, what are they deadbolting into the closet? What are they deadbolting into the bedroom? But again, they're like, oh, look at how affordable it is, though.
But it's such a good price.
It's such a good price. They also had huge, heavy chains attached to both sides of the house, likely meant for big guard dogs. But they went ahead. They just signed the contract. They just bought the house. They said, you know what? It's all just eccentricities. It's all just idiosyncrasies, idiosyncratic behavior. It's all just fine. So let's go ahead. Let's sign the document. And guess what? Now we are the proud owners of Skinwalker Ranch. And the strangeness for them began almost immediately.
They didn't say that, though.
No.
Hey, we bought a ranch is really what it was. It wasn't, hey, we just bought the Skinwalker Ranch.
That was, I will admit, that was artistic liberty on my part.
Thank you.
For anyone who couldn't tell.
Hey, someone's got to draw a line somewhere.
I think this is the perfect time to take just a little bit of a break. We're just going to take a few minutes here. Take a break, and then we're going to get back to the story. Guys, we all know how difficult being an independent content creator can be. Sometimes you just don't have the resources to get that special something to set your production apart from the pack. And that's where this week's sponsor, VideoBlocks.com, comes in. By going to VideoBlocks.com, by utilizing their service, you can immediately get access to over 100,000 stock footage clips. Now, we're talking After Effects templates, we're talking HD footage up to 4K, motion background templates and effects. VideoBlocks.com has everything you need to break down the barrier between independent content creator and professional content creator. This stuff looks professional because it's made by professionals. And the amazing thing about VideoBlocks.com is, in addition to the hundreds of thousands of video clips that they have that you get included, no extra cost included with your subscription, if there is something that's not included in the member libraries, you're going to automatically save 40% off of that normal price. The nice thing about it as well, again, in the vein of independent content creators, is that 100% of the money you spend on any clip goes directly to that clip's creator. So not only are you getting a great deal, you can feel good about it as well, knowing that you're helping other people live their passion just like they're helping you. The amazing thing about videoblocks.com is that all of the content is royalty free. You can use it for commercial purposes, or you can just use it for a nice little at-home video, or who knows, maybe a little podcast promotional video, you know, that sort of thing. It's all royalty free, and that includes even after your subscription has ended with videoblocks.com. You will never, ever get dragged into a royalty fight. You're never going to have to contact this person or that person again. You are just going to need to go to videoblocks.com, type in what you need, and just be amazed at the high quality stock footage that they have to offer. Now, if you go to videoblocks.com/notalone, you're going to get 84% off an annual subscription after a 7-day free trial. That's 84% off just by going to videoblocks.com/notalone. You're looking at just paying $149 for an entire year's worth of stock footage. And again, royalty free. That price, that's all you're paying. So guys, go to videoblocks.com/notalone. I guarantee if you are in the independent content creation game, or even if you're not, even if you're in the professional content creation game, videoblocks.com is the most amazing resource out there. And guys, I gotta tell you, it's amazing. All right, back to the show. The strangeness on the ranch began almost immediately. Right after moving onto the farm, the family, which was composed of Terry and Gwen, their children, a teenage boy and a 10-year-old daughter, as well as Terry's father, were confronted by an absolutely massive grayish-black wolf. Terry, who was a lifelong rancher, claimed that it was 3 times bigger than the biggest wolf he had ever seen, and it approached them from the pasture area gracefully and even lazily weaving its way through the grass. Now, initially, the wolf paused around 50 yards from the family, but it slowly began creeping towards them. As it got closer, Terry estimated that the wolf must weigh around 200 pounds, with its shoulder coming up to his chest. Terry Sherman stood over 6 foot tall. Yeah. Dear Lord, indeed. And we looked this up earlier.
Take it for a ride.
We were having a little bit of a discussion earlier. So 200-pound wolf. And I trust him. I mean, he's been around wolves and cattle and everything all his life. I'm going to trust that he knows how much a thing weighs. The average weight for like a North American gray wolf was like 78 pounds, something like that, 79 pounds. So this wolf is pretty much, like he says, 3 times bigger than any wolf he'd ever seen. I mean, we were sitting here looking at, I have this little love seat, and it's like the wolf is the size of that freaking chair, which now I'm scared of that chair.
And I want one. And not the love seat, I want the wolf.
We both want one. And you know funny? The Shermans wanted one too, because they noticed it was so, like, it was so calm and so nice, and like they were able to pet it. And like,
probably because it just ate the next village.
I've killed everyone I need to kill today.
Picking out its teeth with a toothpick.
There we go.
I'm just like picturing the big bad wolf right now.
I dig
just,
it.
Like, we're good.
I think that's fair.
I've ate 2 pigs. Don't need the third.
Now,
we'll just go straight to my hips.
As they are, thank you. As they are interacting with this wolf, the children who had jumped like on top of the pickup truck, they jump down and they say, oh, this wolf's so nice. And the son, who we know Terry and Gwen's real name. In the book, they're given a pseudonym, but they went public with it a few years ago. We don't know their children's name. And so I'm just going to refer to him using the pseudonyms. The son, whose name was Tad, he like was playing with the wolf, and he even said, like, can we keep it, Papa? Can we keep this wolf? And they were like, well, it would be kind of nice to have this. And then they see,
oh, those chains work perfectly for this thing.
The wolf turns its head and looks towards the corral, which they had just unloaded the first batch of cattle into. And there's one calf who's sticking its head out between the bars.
Uh-huh.
And this wolf that had been lazily, they talked about it even being like zen-like in its movements and its peace and calm and tranquility, it just snaps. It just bolts over there in a flash of an eye, blink of an eye, in a flash, and bites down on this calf's neck. And immediately, as ranchers, that's it. Too bad. It was a cool wolf 3 seconds ago. Now it's attacking my way of making a living. And so immediately, Terry shoots at it with his 357 Magnum from a distance of 10 feet directly into the ribs of the wolf, and it didn't even flinch. Terry shoots it two more times in the abdomen, and at this point, the wolf releases the calf and just turns and looks at Terry. Terry couldn't see any blood or wounds on the beast. It made eye contact with him, and Terry said it was hypnotizing. They were these pale blue, hypnotizing eyes. It still didn't look concerned, and so Terry shot it once more in the heart. This is where it starts backing up. It backs up around 30 feet and then just stands there staring. Now, Terry grabs his .30-06, which is a rifle that he had used to kill elk from hundreds of yards away, and shoots at the wolf. 40 feet away, shoots at the wolf. They hear the bullet make contact, and the wolf recoils a little bit. It's kind of like, if you remember in the Beast of Gay Boudon, they're shooting this thing, and it'll, like, go back, but it still just gets up every time. The next shot from this massive rifle hits the chest, and they see, out of the exit wound, a chunk of flesh and fur fly off the back of the beast and land nearby. The wolf, still silent, but it calmly turns around and just starts to trot away at a little bit quicker than just a normal walk. Terry and his son Tad pursue it through the tree line of the property. They lose sight of the actual beast in thick underbrush, but when they emerge, they're able to clearly see the tracks of the wolf, and they follow them until they're about 25 yards away from a river that ran through the property. The tracks went through some mud, in which it left 1-inch deep impressions, and then they simply stopped. In the middle of this mud, 25 yards away from a river. He's not, I don't care how big he is, he's not going to clear that river.
It's a jump.
It's a jump. It's as if he disappeared into thin air. And this, they talked about this with their neighbors. They were like, oh my gosh, have you seen any wolves? We had the weirdest wolf. And the neighbors were all like, yeah, there's tons of wolves, and they're huge, and they're terrifying. And everyone's like, why didn't you tell me this? But essentially,
you seemed like a really nice family.
You seemed like a nice family. We needed you. The old guys were terrible. But they go to the tribal authorities, because it's on a reservation. It's managed by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which I don't know why we still call it that, but so be it. It's managed by that group, and they go to the tribal police and tribal authorities, and they say, hey, there are these giant wolves on this property we just bought. Like, what are you going to do about this? It's not safe. They're attacking our cattle. And it's actually just Gwen who's doing this, because she has her own experience, which we'll get into in a moment. But the tribal authorities just look at her like, what are you talking about? And they say that the last wolf in Utah, not just this part of Utah, but in Utah, was shot and killed in 1929. And there hadn't been another documented wolf in Utah up until actually the next year they released wolves near the area. It took them about 9 more years to actually make it into town there. But there were no wolves in the entire state at that point. But Gwen, like I said, she had had her own experience wherein she was driving back home. It was a long day at work. She took a job with a local mortgage company. And she noticed out of the corner of her eye some huge shape to the left of her. She sees a gigantic wolf approaching her vehicle. It walks right up to the car, and when it's standing by her window, she realizes that its head is above the car. In the distance, she sees another creature, which was very large, but not as big as the wolf. She said it looked like a dog, but a dog whose head was too big for its already massive body. Now, another source that we use heavily in this series is going to be Ryan Skinner, which is a He is a paranormal researcher who is often regarded as the foremost authority on the ranch, and we'll be getting more into his story and research a little bit in part two. But he believes that this gigantic wolf, described by both Gwen and Terry as having light, blue, hypnotic, almost human-like eyes, because Gwen saw that as it approached her car, he believed that this was the Skinwalker itself. This is the only viable claim to Skinwalkers that the ranch has, beyond it supposedly being cursed. This is the only manifestation of activity that could be linked directly to the Navajo legend.
That's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for everything else that goes on, it's weird that they take up that mantle, that name, instead of being...
I think it is. I think it's because of the legend.
Dire
I think
Wolf it's, Ranch or something like that, you know?
Right. I think it's because some people, I'm told, are, in Skinner's books, he says, some people prefer the term the UFO farm, which we're going to get into pretty much right now. But I think that they choose, or they don't choose to identify it like that. The people around it choose to identify it that way because of this curse, because of the Skinwalker itself that's said to curse the area. And Junior Hicks says that there has been activity on the ranch going back at least 15 generations, and it is all because of that curse of the Skinwalker, you know. Yeah, interesting stuff. And like I said, he talks a little bit more, Ryan Skinner talks a little bit more about the Skinwalkers themselves in this, but we'll leave that for next episode. Now, like I said, one of its other claims to fame is the insane amount of UFO activity that is witnessed on this farm, which it was weird because it really didn't show up that much. They had the initial issue with the wolf, then Gwen had her issue with the wolf, and that was about it for a little while. But pretty much the moment that Terry finished moving his prize cattle, his Black Angus, onto the ranch, the UFO activity skyrockets. Now, Terry, his son, and a visiting nephew were out surveying the herd in the dusk at the end of a day when they noticed a box-like figure which appeared to be an RV that was trespassing on their land. This wasn't uncommon. It was a large amount of land, and very often there would be campers or hunters or people who just kind of wandered on there. But sometimes Terry would let it go. He said, tonight, no, we're going to go. We're going to get these people out of here. Now, the men make their way to the RV. They're about 200 yards away, and the RV slowly begins creeping away from them. The first thing about it that was weird, that they really didn't, it was like subconsciously they identified it, was that the RV was not bumping and jostling around. It was very smoothly, these lights were just very slowly and smoothly getting away from them, and it was getting away from them at the same pace that they were walking. So pretty much they were always exactly 200 yards or right about 200 yards away from this RV. Now they come up, the lights come up to the first in a series of barbed wire fences, and Terry is most concerned that they're going to run over this fence. He's going to have to spend all day fixing this fence. But he sees the lights hover. They go up just a few feet above the ground, go forward, go down.
Uh-oh.
What is that? What is going on here?
It's a hovercraft, Sam.
They run up. Okay, their speed increases. The RV's speed increases. There's one big old 5 foot tall, heavily wired fence that the RV approaches, quote unquote RV approaches. And finally Terry says, okay, well, I don't know how they could have done that, but they're not getting through this. It's just not possible. The lights
go down in the city.
The lights go up in the city. Well, that not in the city. The lights go up in the ranch, further and further, until they're comparing it with the nearby tree line, 50 feet in the air. And at this point, they realize that's not an RV. Now, without a sound, the craft flew off over the trees, and they actually describe it as being an oblong box that looks quite like a refrigerator with a white headlight in the front and a red light in the back. Now, this is the origin of, I don't know if you'll remember me mentioning him, he gave us the Mojave incident story, Rob Christofferson. Remember Rob?
He's
got a death look on his face right now.
I remember Rob.
Rob likes to refer to Skinwalker Ranch as the world's best is your refrigerator running joke. And I agree. I think that's pretty funny.
Yeah, that's fair.
If it wasn't so damn terrifying.
That's also fair.
I can't even imagine just you think you know what's going on, and suddenly it's gone. And that is the theme of this entire freaking area. Now, weeks later, Terry sees this object again.
It is just ridiculous, isn't it?
It is.
It's just so ridiculous.
It is. I know. Weeks later, Terry sees it stands to note. The nephew who was there, his parents picked him up the next day, and they were like, don't invite our son to your house again. Wait, he's not interested in coming back. And he's like, all right, that's fair. Thank you, brother and or sister or whatever. Now, weeks later, Terry would see the object again, this time while he was accompanied by Gwen as they walked a trail through the ranch. Now, they heard a sharp metallic clanging above them, about 20 feet above them in the sky. And about 100 yards ahead of them, they see these lights appear. They start walking towards it. At this point, Terry has told Gwen, they have a very open, communicative relationship, especially when it comes to UFOs, which I think is important.
And you know,
for any relationship to succeed.
You know what's kind of weird?
Huh.
We don't have that many UFO sightings.
In Idaho?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're high desert.
You know, though, we...
desert, it seems to be the key.
We just made the first ever... It's called a dark sky... what's it called? Like a dark sky preserve, which is a dope name. But it's like 1,800 square miles where they're just not going to build any lights. So you will always just be able to go there no matter what. Go look up and see the stars. And I'll tell you what.
That's awesome.
It's not only awesome. It's also where all of the aliens are headed right now. I guarantee it. There are going to be so many alien sightings. Real or not, there are going to be so many UFO sightings here.
There's going to be people seeing other things and saying there's UFOs because they don't
realize. That's fair.
Realize.
But they may also see a real UFO.
I still just don't get why UFO... Okay, if you... built a spaceship right now, would you put a ton of lights
dude,
all over it?
Dude, we've talked about this.
Would you?
This is all a plan.
God.
This is all exactly what they want. They want us to see them. You're just not getting it. You're just not getting it. That's
yeah,
fine.
That's exactly it.
That's
I just
all right.
Don't get it.
That's all right. So they see this craft, right, about 50 yards ahead of them after hearing the clanging in the sky behind them. They move towards it. It gets off the ground, travels 50 yards, sets back down. It does this like two or three times as they're sneaking towards it so that, again, it's about roughly the same area away from them every time. Now, right this time, although this final time, it seems as though it is not starting to lift off. They're getting pretty excited. And then they hear the clanging again, this time from behind them in the same point in the sky. They turn really quick to look at it. By the time they turn back, the lights are gone. The craft is gone. Now,
they've been bamboozled.
They've been bamboozled again. Now, a few weeks later, Terry begins to keep an active watch on the property, especially trying to catch intruders. He still doesn't know this entire
intruder
time.
Intruder alert. Intruder alert. Robinson.
This entire time, he's grappling with what exactly is going on. He is a rancher. He's a sensible man. His first opinion is not aliens, regardless of what he's seen. His first opinion is secret government military testing, which I think is a good opinion to have, for sure.
Okay.
And he sees, as he's patrolling the property that night, he sees a new kind of craft. And it appears to be a smaller hybrid between an F-117 and a B-2 bomber, which are both triangular craft that look like UFOs. I mean, have you seen a B-2?
Yes.
Yeah. It looks like a freaking alien spaceship.
Stealth bomber, right?
Yeah, stealth bomber. Now, this craft appeared to come out of nowhere. What?
They are so cool looking.
They are so cool looking. I know. And the F-17 as well. Triangular, it's a beautiful thing, but it's not as sleek. Like, the B-2 looks like the freaking Cylon ships. To me, it looks like the Cylon ships in Battlestar Galactica.
Are you sure the Cylon ships don't look like it?
Oh, no! Now, this craft seems to appear out of nowhere, and it slowly, like very, very slowly, begins moving towards Terry when he spots it. It projects multicolored lights on the snow, covering the ground. There's no sound of engines or anything else, and for all intents and purposes, yeah, it's moving very slowly towards him, but it's practically just hovering there.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't exert any force on the environment around it. It's only 20 feet off the ground, but there's no disturbance on the ground. On the it's right in front of a ridge. On the ridge behind it, for all intents and purposes, it's like it's not there. Now, it shuts off its lights. It goes up and then down, glides up, then glides down behind the ridge and disappears. Gwen also sees this craft, and she has her own just terrifying, terrifying night. She sees this craft as she's driving back to the ranch one night, and she is alone. Her kids are with friends or something like that. Terry is out on a business trip to the city. She's all around, all alone on Skinwalker Ranch. And as she's driving home, the craft slowly flies over her car, projecting these same kind of multicolored, they describe them as disco lights, as it goes onto the ground beneath it. Now, that's freaky enough, but she kind of just lets it go. It goes off towards the direction of the ranch house. And that same night, later on, she looks out of her home, out of her windows of her home while doing her dishes, and she sees what appears to be a large RV parked around 200 yards away from the home. The thing about this is, like I said earlier, this did happen. So they didn't automatically assume UFOs every time. They just Right. assumed trespassers. And the strange thing was, she could see, it's dark outside, but she sees a light coming through what appears to be a window in the RV.
Okay.
And in this light, she sees what appears to be a desk. Now, a figure comes out of nowhere and sits behind this desk. It's all black and even appeared to be wearing some kind of headgear. Suddenly, the figure just stands up and a doorway appears in the RV, just exuding bright, bright light. The being stands out in front of it, and Gwen estimated that if this was the size of a normal RV, this being has to be at least 7 feet tall. It's covered all black, with a black visor, wearing knee-high black boots. It doesn't do anything. It just stands there and looks directly through her window at her.
That's not creepy.
It's probably the scariest thing that could happen, I would say.
Yeah, that's creepy.
Unless it was, instead of that, it was a wolfman right outside the window. That might be a little scarier to me. She shuts the blinds, and she immediately calls Terry and says, "Listen, I know it's like the dead of night, and I know you are hours away.
But weird stuff's going on.
Yeah, I need you." And Terry, the man Sherman, my boy, he comes driving back. He drives all through the night to get there in the morning. They go out together. The RV is gone. There's no figure that's there that they can see. Mm-hmm. But what they both see at the same time are gigantic 18-inch footprints right where this figure was said to have stood. Now, there are countless other UFO encounters on the ranch. We could talk about just the UFOs for an entire episode, but we got to keep moving on. Like I said, Hunt for the Skinwalker. Get that book. It's amazing. It's going to have all these great, great, great stories, but we're going to move forward to my personal favorite phenomena that happens on the ranch in a section that I like to call
The Cake's a Lie.
The Cake is a Lie, subtitled Now You're Thinking with Portals.
Oh, goody.
You hear about portals, right?
No.
You hear, well, sorry.
I understand the idea of
portals. We understand the idea of portals, but actual people saying, like, yes, I saw a portal. The people who usually report those kinds of things are usually, and I'm not trying to stereotype here, usually the people that I don't necessarily count as reliable witnesses. And again, I've been that person before. But the Shermans, throughout all of this, everyone who has ever met them, ever interviewed them, says, like, these people seem, if they're lying, this is, like, one heck of a lie, and they are telling it so well. You have, though, like I said with the wolves, you also do have other activity, other UFO activity, not only through the whole basin, which we covered, but specifically neighbors talking about seeing, like, these RVs that are there and then disappear, seeing lights coming on and off of the Sherman Ranch during the entire time. So this is pretty well corroborated, but this is one thing that can only be seen from the ranch. And every member of the Sherman family, every member of the family is familiar with this. These great orange structures that would appear in the sky.
Now, was it like an actual, like, structure? Or was it just like a rift?
Good question. It's not just a rift. So,
you're going to elaborate on that at all?
Yes, I am right now.
Okay.
So, these can only be viewed from one specific point on the ranch, and even then only when being viewed at the correct angle. Otherwise, if you move around it, if you're in the wrong area, look in the wrong way, it kind of just disappears. From the road outside of the ranch, the people would talk about seeing orange clouds, orange lights, but not necessarily these structures. And the best place to see it was the Sherman's homestead.
I mean, of course.
Of course. The actual best place to see it as well was a tree, cut down tree, with a 4-foot tall stump that Terry would sit on. And he'd sit there.
I wonder why the tree got cut down.
I wonder why. He'd sit there with his night scope for his
Terry's
rifle.
Viewing pleasure.
Yes. With his night scope on for his rifle, and he'd just sit there and observe these structures. Like I said, they are actual structures. They always appeared in roughly the same place about a mile away, or appeared to be about a mile away.
Do we have any information on what they looked like at all? Like it was...
Sometimes they were, like, elongated, oval-shaped. Other times they were perfect circle, and in a way that...
I kind of meant a little bit more detail to it.
Well, in a way that would appear as if it was a large harvest moon, right?
Okay.
That orange, that big, that bright.
Does it look like a Stargate?
That's a good question.
That is what I want to know, Sam. That's...
If you're sitting there looking at it, okay, without the aid of the scope or anything else, you're just seeing a big orange, either
thing,
oval,
yeah,
blob, anything like that. Using the scope, Terry would look right in the dead center of these things, and they always appeared at night. But he would see a blue sky through the other end of it. Sometimes it was just like flat and then the sky's in the center. Another time it seemed as though you have the outside of the tunnel here, or the outside of the structure, and then a tunnel going through it, many, many layers.
Interesting, okay.
Going deeper and deeper, but always to this blue sky on the other end. And once, well, actually twice, Terry's sitting there watching this, and he sees a black shape coming from that blue sky through the tunnel. And it's moving at such speed, and it is so huge, he can't even get a good reading on it. I mean, we get so many details from Terry Sherman of different size of things, different locations, different shapes. With this, he can say it was maybe triangular.
Okay.
Because yeah, it's moving so quick, it's so huge.
Well,
he can't
it's so
even
far
see
away,
it.
Too.
It's so far away. And it comes right out of this tunnel and right over the homestead and flies away. The same thing happens when he is viewing it from a different angle, where it does look more of just like a rift, and mm-hmm, it's just the same thing. Some fast-moving, huge object just comes out of this portal. And this is the first time when he says, maybe this isn't the government. Like, can the government do this? Is this possible? Maybe this is something extra dimensional.
Well, I mean, we just looked at the Philadelphia experiment, so mm-hmm. obviously we can.
Obviously, the government has this capability.
We've had that technology for a while now.
The interesting thing about it, have you ever seen, like, a GIF of a four-dimensional cube?
No.
Okay, they're trippy as heck.
What does it do?
It's... I can't describe it. Look
What's
it up.
The
Look
fourth
it up.
Dimension on it?
Look up four... It's, like, not the fourth dimension being time, like a fourth physical dimension. Look up 4D cube gift. GIF. Everybody 4D. Do that at home, too. Pause. Don't Google it. We're going to put a link to a video of a 4D cube in the blog post, which will be notalonepodcast.com/skinwalkerranch1. Skinwalker-ranch1. So go
Dude,
check
I
that out.
I can watch this all day.
And that's exactly what this makes me think of. You know, being in the third dimension, we can only perceive third dimensional objects, but because they are fourth dimensional, they will change in an even greater way than a normal object would change.
Yeah, the first comment on this video, my 3D mind cannot comprehend what's going on here.
Exactly. That's what it makes me think of, is a fourth dimensional object. So perhaps it is some sort of a doorway that connects two three-dimensional worlds, or even a three-dimensional and a four-dimensional world. It's pretty wild. Jason is just sitting here staring, and I'm loving it. Now, we'll see. One of the most amazing things about this is that the Shermans were not the only people to see these structures, and that we're going to leave for part two. But we got to move on. That's
okay,
my favorite.
All right.
But we got to move
back.
On to our next on the poo-poo platter of the paranormal. Now,
poo-poo platter.
That's what they call those sorts of things. When it's like a sampler of all these different appetizers.
I don't like
platter.
That. Ew.
All right. Now, as we mentioned before many times by now, Terry is an...
Let's go salad bar. It's the salad bar of paranormal
That's fair.
Activity.
That's
you
fair.
Just get a little bit of this at the base, and then you just keep adding more stuff
you know
to
what
the
happens
top,
when
it just
I,
starts
when I was a kid,
falling over.
Wait, do you know what I would do at the salad bar as a kid?
Just scoop chocolate pudding.
I would get bacon crumbles,
yeah.
breadsticks, and ranch dressing. And Dear. I would just like...
This explains a lot.
Scoop it. I'm so fat. All right. All right.
All right. So we've got portals. We've got UFOs. We've got crazy paranormal...
Creatures.
Wolves
mm-hmm.
and cattle mutilations.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and
that's where we are right now.
Sea serpents. Yeah.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert, cattle mutilations.
That's where we are right now. So, Terry is.
I can't keep track, obviously.
That's okay. Terry is an accomplished rancher, well known. His pride
we
was.
We covered that.
Yep. His pride was his herd. Now, beyond the personal pride he took in his work, the cattle was his family's primary source of income. Without them, they simply could not feed themselves. And I get the sense that Gwen's job was probably more or less something to keep her busy and happy than to really make ends meet. So when Terry's cattle start ending up dead, this becomes a little bit more serious than just spooky, scary times. Now, typically, ranchers consider a 4% loss of a herd acceptable within a season, and are able to sustain that much without risking their livelihood. But Terry Sherman took it personally when he lost more than 1% of his herd during that same period of time. It is possible...
Wow, Terry, it would have been overachiever.
It is possible, based on what we know about the ranch, and what we'll discuss some more in part 2 or part 3, however that shakes out, in the theory section, it is possible that this devotion and this intense feeling he had of shepherding over this herd was part of the reason why what happened next happened. Now, as Jason said, we're talking cattle mutilations, and these have been reported in the Uintah Valley or the Uintah Basin since cattle mutilations were a thing, which started back in the late 60s, early 70s in the United States.
So you mean like since we started actually recording and reporting them?
Right, exactly.
I'm sure cattle mutilations have been around for a while longer than that.
Right, right. When it became a national news thing, essentially. Now, these mutilations obviously had continued in full force into the 90s. Terry Sherman was not the first rancher in the area to lose cattle to this phenomena. But the first case here was just one of absence. Now, right after a big snowstorm in the winter of 94, bridging into 95, Terry realized that one of his prize breeding stock had disappeared into the blizzard. He traced her tracks through the fresh snow, and as they progressed, he realizes that she's picking up speed. She's starting to run until she's finally running as fast as she physically can. And you don't have to be a zoologist to know that predators usually aren't out hunting in the middle of a blizzard. But this cow was definitely running from something. There's no other tracks following it, no sign of what could be causing the distress. And after navigating through the trees, it breaks into a clearing where in the middle of this clearing, in a foot-deep snow, or a snow that is a foot deep, the tracks stop without a trace. He's estimating this cow to be at least 1,000 pounds. And he says, I don't know of a helicopter that could just, in the middle of a blizzard, come down, scoop up this cow, and it's gone. This cow is never seen again. No bodies found, no nothing. This was followed by 4 other similar disappearances until a body finally was found. One of the biggest arguments, I'm saying this mostly for Chris Cogswell of the Mad Scientist podcast, because we talked in depth about cattle mutilation on our last episode of The Lowdown. One of the biggest arguments against cattle mutilation is that it's just a natural death presenting natural, albeit extremely strange, signs. The parts of the body that are often missing are these same ones that would be attacked and eaten first by predators, or would decay at the fastest rate.
Yeah, soft stuff.
The soft stuff, exactly. Soft tissues. Now, the wounds, you also often eyes, hear about...
bellies. Yeah.
You often also...
fun stuff. Organs.
Organs. All right. You often also hear of...
Oh, the Discovery Channel.
Yeah, that's fair. Of wounds with a surgical nature to them. Especially when it comes to like the gut and other areas, the rectum, things like that. And the most popular scientific explanation is simply that these wounds, especially in hot weather, will very quickly, you'll get these gases that bloat the cow, and then the cow goes pop. And it does it in such a way that it creates this surgical line, this surgical incision. But these factors take time, at least several hours, if not days, which is usually about the time it takes to find a dead cow. And it's left to bake in the hot sun during all that time. It's going to naturally decompose in certain ways. But in April of 1995, a heavy rainstorm rolls into the ranch. Terry and his son, they are paranoid at this point because they are losing so many cattle. They are losing their livelihood that they say, screw waiting till after the storm. We are going into the storm. We are going to keep these cows safe. We're going to make sure everything is fine. And his son, again, referred to by his pseudonym Tad, he's tracking down a calf when he notices a heifer that's trapped in a canal, whining, bleeding, moaning, trying to get out, but unfortunately it can't because it's stuck in the mud. And Tad makes a mental note and then says, okay, I'm going to be back for that, but I got to get this calf. So he's running, he gets it 20 minutes later from seeing this cow. 20 minutes later, in the middle of a rainstorm, he returns to this heifer and immediately, after vomiting, calls for his father. Because this heifer is dead. Its rectum is carved out. There's no blood in the mud, in the stream, no other tracks around the cow. Although, to be fair, rainstorm, mud, probably won't be there anyway.
Is there signs of any pet detectives?
There are no pet detectives. Ace Ventura was not here.
No?
No.
He didn't get the cow mistaken for a rhino?
No. Shoot. Sure is hot in these cows. That doesn't work as well. The main wound on the cow that seemed to have caused the death was, like I said, the carving out of the rectum, perfect 6-inch across, I think it was 18 inches deep.
Should add Chipotle away.
Mm-hmm. 18 inches deep circle in the heifer's rear. Now, from there, again, space of 20 minutes, that happened. So, take that as you will. From there, cattle mutilations become, like the UFO sightings...
I'll take that as a perceived amount of time. That's how I'll take it.
They become, well, technically the first article I found says that it was 5 minutes. So we're even giving it like perception some more time. From there, cattle mutilations became, like the UFO sightings, a matter of unfortunate normalcy on the ranch. 3 months later, Terry would see mysterious lights flying around the cattle one night. And these lights, kind of just like with Junior Hicks' book, Junior Hicks and Frank Salisbury, there are so many reports of lights that they only focus on the craft because these lights are there all the time. Blue lights, green lights, red lights, yellow lights. They are always on the ranch. There's something. I don't know about purple lights. And it's to the point where they don't even register, nor do they particularly care. But one day, one night, they see them flying around these cattle. The next morning, Terry goes to check on the cattle, finds one of them dead. Its rectum and sex organs are carved out surgically. But he also notices a pool of brown liquid near the body that appeared to be quickly evaporating in the sun. He touched it. It was very cold. It smelled of chemicals. He rode home on his horse as quick as he could to get a container to put the gel-like substance in, but when he returned, it was completely gone.
That is fast.
That is fast.
That is very, very quick.
Yeah, for anything to evaporate.
That has a low boiling point.
Yeah. I mean, there's been water on this table since we started recording, and it's still here.
Well,
I'm just saying, man. That's quick.
Wait, where was that liquid found again?
By the calf.
By
the cow. Yeah.
The mutilated cow.
Yeah, by the body of the cow.
So if it was injected into the cow, it would have warmed up and evaporated faster than what was experienced and observed.
Okay.
So maybe it's some sort of...
Maybe it causes...
weird toxin?
Bloating and...
I don't know.
Okay. That's fair.
Maybe.
He didn't get sick after touching it or anything like that.
Weird. Okay, I don't know, man. That beats me.
I think that's some good science, though.
It's interesting.
It's cold. What could it's it be evaporating used for? Quickly. Low boiling point. Scientists, get at us. Tell us. If that sounds like anything you know, please let me know. Around this time, their story finds its way to the local news, and the media interviews the family who tell of the cattle going missing, cattle being mutilated. People start showing up. They start knocking on the door of the property saying, hey, let me in. I want to look at this. I want to
blow your house down.
I want to blow your house down. Big bad wolf. And the majority of the time, Terry just tells them to shove it and leave. But there's this one individual.
Wears him down a little bit.
Just shows up, 6'2", well-built gentleman, blonde hair. This guy shows up and he says, I'd like to meditate on the ranch. For some reason or another, Terry says, fine. But we're going to drive in my truck. You're going to tell me where you want to go. And once it's done, it's done. So don't come back. Hit the road, Jack. And they drive to a small pasture surrounded by trees. They essentially just are driving and driving. And finally, the guy says, there, I want to meditate there. And Terry goes over, pulls over. He stays in the truck.
He really just had to use the bathroom.
Terry stays in the truck, and the stranger gets out and starts meditating. He sits down in the center of the clearing. He's about 100 yards away from the trees. And everything's just completely and beautifully silent. It's really nice. It's serene. I'm sure the gentleman is having a wonderful time. And then suddenly there's the sound of a cowbell. And Terry says, what? Did you hear that, Tad? Tad's like, yeah.
What?
What? They're looking around. They don't see any cows. The cowbell only happens for a second and then stops. But they do see some kind of movement very fast in the tree line, 100 yards away from this guy. And Terry starts to feel uneasy. He actually tries to call out to the stranger, telling him to come back. But before he can, something that looks like a heat distortion, a shimmering, like when the heat's coming pavement, something that's what it looks like, breaks out of the tree, runs up inches from this individual and roars so loud, it's said that the entire ranch can hear it. Half bear, half lion, the man runs. Terry gets out of his truck and is like, oh no, I don't want this guy dying on my property. The man runs to Terry, grabs him. The whatever it was runs back into the trees, and the man is holding on to Terry, and Terry says, I need you to let me go. And he says, I'm only going to let you go if you promise to take me out of here. And he's like, okay, but please, seriously though, stop holding me. And the guy says, okay. They drive back. The guy leaves, never comes back. Years later, Terry and Tad, and I assume Gwen and the daughter, why not? Let's make it a family thing. They're sitting together watching Predator.
Nice.
So they're watching it, and in Predator, the creature, the Predator, is cloaked. And as right. soon as they see this cloaked Predator, they both scream, that's what we saw.
A Hollywood movie?
They saw the Predator.
Perfect. I'm so excited about that. I'm glad we got that solved. Mystery.
The Predator is what's out. Causing this. Now, the final straw for Terry and Gwen comes suddenly one evening. Gwen is pretty much ready to go once the cows start dying, but there was also
I could see that.
There is also a large amount of poltergeist activity on the ranch. Household items would often disappear and then reappear, like in the microwave.
We're talking like, oh, someone just wants to heat up some food for you.
Someone wants to heat up some scissors for you, or some knife, or some stapler, or some rolling pin for you.
How do you fit a rolling pin in a microwave?
I'm sure my microwave could fit a rolling pin. Maybe not. Anyway. Maybe. So that's happening constantly in the house. Terry has this 70-pound post hole digger that he comes in cursing up a blue streak about losing one day.
Wait, 70 pounds? It's huge.
Oh, dude, have you ever used one of these things?
Yes.
Yeah, dude. They're gigantic, and they're heavy, and they hurt. I used them building fences with my dad. I don't think his was 70 pounds, though.
How old were you at the time, Sam?
I was like 14.
So it felt 70 pounds.
Yeah. But I am sure that there are 70-pound postal diggers out there.
This must be a big post.
They're gigantic. Anyway. So he comes up cursing a blue streak saying, you know, where's my post? Somebody tell me where my digger is. I need it. Nobody fesses up. Months later, they find the postal digger 20 feet up in a tree. On the property.
Those darn kids.
And Gwen is ready to go the whole time, doesn't feel safe in her own home, and for good reason. But Terry says, no.
So, wait. You have poltergeist activity.
Mm-hmm.
And the previous owners thought it was going to be fixed with double deadbolting everything?
Well, it might go a little bit to explain the deadbolts keeping things in. As well as keeping them out. I don't know. If you got a rogue pair of scissors or something.
If something is powerful.
Right.
Enough to put scissors, rolling pin into another object where right. they have to physically open up a door. Why wouldn't they just be able to...
So what are you going to do? You're just going to leave all the locks off the door and say, too bad, I'm going to die. That sucks. You're going to fight. You're going to have that self-preservation.
I'm going to leave.
Well, you are going to leave.
That's what I'm going to do,
but
Sam.
These previous owners had been there since the 50s. I mean, they were there for a long time.
They also
long
died
time.
There.
Well, that's because they were old people. They weren't killed by, well, maybe. Anyway, so Gwen's ready to go. Terry
yeah.
is not.
Post-hole digger in the tree.
Post-hole
That's
digger
where we're
in
at.
The tree.
That's where we're
now,
at.
Now, one night, he and Gwen are standing outside their home watching the cattle graze.
Aw.
It's not fun. It's not nice. They're very anxious. They're very, very stressed. And they see something that they saw 100 times before, a blue light flying around, and it flies through the tree line towards one of the horses. And it just begins to circle the head of one of the horses, who just really seems like it's annoyed.
How big's the light?
You'll see.
No, I won't, Sam. You have no photos here.
You'll hear.
Okay.
It's circling the head of this horse just over and over, who treats it just like it's a fly. Just
Yeah.
You know, trying to get it out of there. Now, the Shermans had, of course, seen these before, but it was always at a distance.
Mm-hmm.
This light comes up to them. It's about 20 feet away from them when it stops. Fairy? Well, it's about three times the size of a baseball, and it appears to be made...
So like a cantaloupe size?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fruit.
Good. It appears to be made of glass, and within the glass is a blue liquid that swirls around, and they hear this electrical crackling sound coming from it.
The horse was just like, meh.
Well, this horse probably sees it all the time up close. Gwen immediately shines her flashlight at it, and it darts away. Terry and Gwen both feel completely and utterly horrified and terrified, and while they definitely had reason to be, Terry claims that it is an artificial emotion, that the fear was projected into them. While it would have been natural to be unsettled, there was no need for the kind of world-ending fear they experienced looking at this. Now,
it's like looking into the Eye of Mordor.
Exactly.
Called
Eye of Sauron. Yeah.
Yeah.
They go back into their home. And this light comes back with a few of its buddies and just starts circling the house.
Fred and the gang.
And as it circles, the lights go dim and go bright. Go dim and go bright, like there was a dimmer. But there was no dimmer in the house. It's just pulsating at this point. Not like that. Now, the final straw for the Shermans came in April of 1996. Terry was sitting outside relaxing with his favorite dogs, three heelers of great quality, good breeding, fantastic nature for ranching. The dogs begin barking and pulling at their tether, and Terry, without even thinking, just kind of lets him go run when he sees a blue orb in the distance. The dogs are rushing towards it, and it would dip down as if it could just be snatched by their jaws.
Oh, they're playing.
And then go back up.
They got a friend.
They're playing. And the light begins to lead these dogs away from the house.
No, they're not playing.
And into a thick grove of trees.
Please tell me we don't hear like yelps.
And you hear this bark, bark, bark. And they're having fun and they're having a great time. As soon as they're out of Terry's sights, it turns to yelps and whines and silence. And Terry knows. Terry knows he cannot bring himself to go. And so he goes to bed and thinks maybe they'll come back. In the morning, no dogs. He goes into this grove of trees where he finds three large, perfect circles of dead grass. And in the middle of each circle is a black, greasy pile of something. And that was it. The family officially has had enough. They sell the ranch. And there was definitely an interested buyer. An eccentric billionaire who made his fortune selling low-cost housing and used it to invest in space technology. A man who has publicly stated... we're not even going to say who it is. We're going to leave it on
a teaser. Okay, that's fine.
A man who has publicly stated his belief that aliens have not only visited this planet, but walk among us. He was the man who came knocking. And after purchasing the ranch, he deployed a team of scientists to make measurements of the phenomena, including ex-military members, as well as a board of PhD scientists. And this will be our subject for episode 2 in our series on Skinwalker Ranch.
I can't wait.
We did it. We made it.
Oh, God.
Skinwalker Ranch Part 1 in the books. What do you think? We're not in.
I can't wait to
yet.
Get into some science.
Some science. Cool. Guys, I have no idea how long this is going to be because we made two recording files. This one's at an hour and 45 minutes. The first one was at about 45 minutes. So it's at least 2.5 hours of our lives, your lives, really, that you're spending with us, and we appreciate that.
I'm so sorry.
Now because of. don't apologize. Because of our crossover episode last week, we did not have a chance to thank our reviewers or our patrons. So that's what we're going to do now.
Good, because I got some heat for that.
Did we?
I did.
Did you?
I personally.
What?
Yes.
Why?
Because we didn't shout out one of our new Patreons, and she's my neighbor.
Oh, what the heck? Oh, well, thank you, neighbor. I'll let Jason do that one. But first,
you don't know who what her name is.
That's true.
So you'll just go through the names, and be like, I'll deal with it.
Okay. I'll deal with it. All right. Okay. So for right now, though, we're gonna start with our reviews. Which, by the way, everybody, we have over 100 reviews in the iTunes store. We actually right now have 103.
What?
Yeah. Thank you, guys. That is so great. That makes me so happy, and especially with the new beautiful iOS 11 and its updated podcast app, it looks dope.
Does it?
It looks dope. Go ahead, open it up. Take a look. The new podcast app is dope. I've already mentioned that I think I'm going to go back to using it.
Dude, we're like the fifth thing.
For what?
When I start typing a nut.
Oh yeah, we come up super quick now.
Yeah.
Super quick. Anyway.
Ooh.
So we have a good amount here. We're going to read two of them, but let's thank everyone first. So we'd like to thank Stacy Schmidt. We'd like to thank Crushed Roses. We'd like to thank Funny the Way It Turned Out. We'd like to thank Katie Fred. We'd like to thank Rick Smiths. We'd like to thank Kayla Kwanowski. We'd like to thank Nuclear Teapot. We'd like to thank Susie QF. We'd like to thank Blucy, and we'd like to thank On Another Note. Guys, that's
thank
so
you,
many
folks.
Reviews. That's so many reviews. It's crazy. But thank you all so much. That's fantastic. We're going to read two of them. Like I said, one of the people who read the reviews was Katie Fred, who is my wife. I'm going to be completely transparent. And she told me I had to read this.
Ooh.
So that's what we're going to do.
Ooh. What does it say?
She says,
there's one with an emoji on it.
Yeah, that's hers. She loves emojis.
There it is.
She says, Not Alone is my favorite podcast, which is funny because Katie doesn't listen to the podcast because it spooks her, but it's her favorite podcast. Sam and Jason have such funny banter. Sam really researches his stuff well, which she knows because I spend a lot of time researching. And she's like, can we go hang out?
Dude, we're at 105 now.
Like, no. What? We're up to 105?
Yeah.
Holy crap, people. You're beautiful. Anyway, sorry. Let me do this again. Not Alone is my favorite podcast. Sam and Jason have such funny banter. Sam really researches his stuff well. You can tell he works really hard at making the show and that this is his passion. One of the best shows out there. Plus, Sam is fine as hell with a winky face emoji.
Oh, snap.
So that one was obviously like a nice thing for me. Thank you, Katie. I love you very much.
I'm gonna go
say hello to you in like 3 minutes here. But the next one I want to read is by Nuclear Teapot, who states this. I love this review. She states, he states, they state, I actually like Jason.
Hey,
that is the title of this review. I actually like Jason.
Do people not like me?
No, people like you anyway, oh, okay, which is good. Weird. But all I right. just love that was like the thing that they say.
Yes.
Now, first off, I love this podcast. I was hooked since the first episode and eagerly await each new episode. What I enjoy the most about Not Alone is its casual, approachable style, but still very factual. It's obvious that Sam and usually Jason do their homework. P.S. As a fellow art major, I can never forgive Jason his Louvre mistake, but I do
Whatever.
Think he is great.
Whatever.
I do think he is great, and I love the skepticism he
does
brings
it,
to
Does
the
it
show.
Really matter? Does it really matter
I
where
really
it's hanging?
I think it does.
Does it really matter where it's hanging up?
I really think it does. Guys, thank you so much to everybody who left a review, and apparently there's like two more people whose reviews haven't showed up yet. It'll do that. It'll update the number, but not actually show the review for like another 12 to 24
okay.
hours. So we will call you out on next week, but thank you guys so much.
Nice.
And then we have all of our new patrons. So
I don't know why I have the final countdown
That's
going
okay.
on in my head all the time now.
So
all there
we did
ever
Matt,
is.
We did Mark. Okay. So we'd like to thank, is this one your neighbor?
I don't know.
Stephanie?
Yeah.
Okay.
It is my neighbor.
You say it.
Thank you, Stephanie.
No. You have to say we'd like to thank Stephanie
We'd like to thank Stephanie Dawn.
Yay,
Stephanie!
That was his neighbor, so now I'm going to do the rest.
All right.
We'd like to thank Cecilia Garman.
Yay, Cecilia!
We'd like to thank Stacy Schmidt.
Woo, Stacy!
We'd like to thank Izzy LaPou.
Yeah, Izzy.
Is that it? I think that's it.
Cool.
Dope. Guys, and we are also above $200 a month on Patreon, which our goal right now is $250, so that we can actually start upgrading our hardware as well as just buy a lot of spooky books and also invest a little bit more heavily in merchandising. If you enjoy the podcast, if you get value out of it and out of the 2.5 hours that this may turn out to be, feel free to go to patreon.com/notalonepodcast for the price of one coffee, one hamburger, one Little Caesar's pizza. You could say, you know what? I like these guys. I like what they do. They're worth $5. But in any case, we are just so happy you're our listener. The best thing to do to support us beyond iTunes reviews, even beyond Patreon, is just tell a friend. If you have a friend who likes podcasts, tell that friend. If you have a friend who doesn't like podcasts, tell that friend. We could be that podcast. Teamwork makes the dream work. All right.
Love it, Sam. Love it.
And we'd also like to thank our first ever sponsor, Videoblocks.com, for sponsoring this episode. Remember, go to Videoblocks.com/notalone for your special offer of getting their services at a discounted rate, as well as a seven-day free trial to really see what they're all about. So thanks to Videoblocks. And also, Jason wrote potatoes at the bottom of this note. So
I did.
Potatoes. I'm trying to think.
You wrote that, Sam.
No, I didn't. I would have remembered that.
So, under more similar to Not Alone podcast,
right.
There's one that's called Blurry Photos.
Oh, yeah, dude. They're in Dark Myths with us.
Ah, that makes sense.
They're fantastic. They're really funny people.
That sounds wonderful.
Let's do that. I was thinking, who are we going to shout out this episode?
Blurry Photos.
They are so funny. They have
And they have almost 200 episodes.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. 200 episodes or so. They also are also the best podcast in Chicago. They were voted that. So,
whoa.
You know that's legit. They are very good at what they do. Go check out Blurry Photos. Cool.
Sounds
fun. What was it? Urang Medan, The Mad Gasser. They recently reached out and were like, hey, we're also going to cover this thing. I can't remember what it was, but whatever it was.
The Mass Hysteria?
Whatever it was, the whether it was hysteria. The Gasser or the Urang Medan or Jeff or whatever, you'll get to hear another great take, not only on something recent, but they have covered so many things. And they have such a great diversity of topics. Not only is it your definite spooky, scary stuff, but it's also history and really anything interesting or not even paranormal, but anomalous in history, they will really focus on. They also had an episode on Anjikuni Lake. So that's pretty good too, but yeah, go check out Blurry Photos. Unexpected, but the plug is there. Also just go to darkmyths.org and check out all the podcasts there. Cool. Also go to our podcast website, notalonepodcast.com, or you can just Google Not Alone Podcast.
Oh, that's so easy.
What?
Just Google it.
Okay,
I love
you.
It.
You can also go to Facebook. We're on Facebook at Not Alone Podcast. We're on Instagram at Not Alone Podcast. We're on Twitter at Not Alone Pod. Email us at notalonepodcast@gmail.com. Guys, we're trying to do this listener special. Get at me. Tell me your spooky stories. You can either write them down and we're going to have a friend from work come in and read them. He's got a beautiful, beautiful reading voice. Or if you prefer, record yourself. Send them to me. If we decide to use them, we'll of course ask for your permission first. Ask if you want it to be anonymous or if you want people to know your name. Whatever you're comfortable with. But probably in the last week of October, we were going to do the first week, but I forgot to publicize this. So in the last week of October,
good job.
We're going to do just a spooky listener story submitted special. So yeah, guys, send it in. notalonepodcast@gmail.com. Cool.
Sweet, man.
Nobody did wrap? It
what?
Last week.
Oh.
We didn't do it last week. And
who
we
did
had
the week before?
What was the week before? Jeff? Yeah. That was me, you I think, because I said something about screaming at your wall. So, go ahead, Jason. What do you got?
God, so much. There's so much.
We're at a minute 58, or an hour 58. Do it before it hits 2 hours, please. Please kill me. Jason, for the love of God, say something.
I got nothing.
Do you want me to do it? I'll do it.
Yeah, do it.
Okay,
do it.
Come up with. Since we missed last week, we're going to do a reset. Jason is brain fried. So
there's so much spooky.
Remember, whether you made a sound investment, bought a house in the suburbs,
I was thinking that too.
And plan to retire and die peacefully in your own bed after a long, happy life, or you went for the cheap option, we are not alone.